2020当年政策调整。
Unit 20
Policy Adjustment
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape
and interpret the following passage from English
into Chinese.
Good morning. I am glad to have the opportunity to meet with business leaders and colleagues here in Mexico today. In many ways, Canada and Mexico are partners. We share common issues and challenges. We both share borders with the United States.The most important export market for each of us. Both Canada and Mexico have recently faced setbacks in cross-border trade with the United States. These stem not only from weaker U.S. domestic demand, but also from specific trade problems and from border crossing delays associated with tighter security. We have both been affected by the slowdown in the world economy and by global economic imbalances.Although the impact of these factors appears to have been somewhat less in Canada than in Mexico over the past 3 years. And we are both working on the structural adjustments that are necessary to weather shock and to thrive in a changing environment. Today, I want to focus my remarks on Canada's adjustment to global economic changes. I will talk about our efforts to adjust to longer-term economic forces.And about our challenges in this regard, and thus to better manage and adjust to change. I will conclude with some thoughts about how Canada and Mexico can continue to adjust to the economic changes that face us in the future. Both Canada and Mexico are going to need to increase productivity in the face of fierce competition from lower-cost countries. Indeed,It is clear that all countries are going to have to find ways to become more competitive. In Canada, we have an opportunity in the next few years to realize solid, steady productivity gains again, thanks to past investments in information and communications technology. Of course, technology alone is not enough to guarantee higher productivity. To actually realize productivity gains,Enterprises must make the necessary investments and organizational changes, and they must train their staff to use technology to its best advantage. Other forces in the world economy bear watching. These include significant imbalances in global current and capital account flows, and new players, particularly in Asia, are becoming increasingly powerful in the global economy.As I've mentioned, that increases the competitive pressure facing our manufacturers. But it also means new, fast-growing sources of demand and new opportunities. In the face of all of these forces, what kinds of economic adjustments will be needed in the future? Let me speak about the adjustments that we in Canada will have to make. First, our economy will need more high-productivity activities.For significant gains in productivity to resume, governments must ensure that their microeconomic policies encourage flexibility and do not hinder innovation in the public and private sectors. Canada already benefits from an educated and skilled labor force. Nevertheless, workers must continue to have access to the training they need to take advantage of new technologies.And businesses need to ensure that their organizational structure and practices allow them to realize the potential of these new technologies. Second, Canada, like Mexico, must keep its fiscal house in order. We have made great strides in reducing our ratio of public debt to GDP. That ratio will need to decline further.To give Canada the flexibility to meet the demands of our aging population. Third, we must provide the appropriate microeconomic policies with regard to labor markets, intellectual property law, environment, and foreign investment, among others. Fourth, we must ensure that our social policies strike a balance between facilitating the adjustments that need to be made and supporting those members of our society who are displaced by structural adjustment. Fifth, I believe that it is crucial that Mexico and Canada continue working together and with our U.S. partners to make NAFTA even more successful, and the benefits we have seen from NAFTA should strengthen our resolve to see freer trade globally. We need to continue to work towards reduced trade barriers at the Doha round of multilateral trade negotiations. It won't be easy, but the long-term economic benefits will make our efforts worthwhile. What is the role of monetary policy in all of this? As always, it is to facilitate adjustments by helping to maintain the balance between supply and demand in our economies. For the Bank of Canada, this means that we will aim to maintain inflation near 2% by trying to keep the economy operating as close as possible to its full production capacity. But it also means that, at the same time, we will be aware of the longer-term forces that are driving adjustments in our economy. In Canada, we know that with a stronger currency, the economy will have to rely more on domestic demand and less on foreign demand for ongoing solid growth. We will take this into account as we set monetary policy. Both Canada and Mexico have, as a critical element of their monetary policy frameworks, a flexible exchange rate. This gives monetary authorities the ability to set monetary policy tailored to our own domestic economic circumstances. A floating Canadian dollar or floating Mexican peso facilitates the necessary economic adjustments and sends important price signals to economic participants. For many firms and many employees, we know that adjustment can be painful and difficult. But in today's world, not adjusting is not an option. Global demand is strengthening, and credit conditions are good. We have a better knowledge of what we need to do, and we have made important progress in strengthening our macroeconomic frameworks. The challenges that we will face make it even more important that we continue to strengthen our policy frameworks in order to adjust to changing circumstances and to take advantage of potential gains. The faster we are able to adjust, the greater the wealth we can create for our citizens, and the more our societies will surely benefit.
第21单元, 法律治安.
Unit 21, Law and Order.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's how Abraham Lincoln described the American government in his Gettysburg Address. These simple phrases capture the essence of American democracy. Instead of ruling over U.S. citizens, the government is ruled by them. Elected officials are known as public servants who represent their constituents. Americans can get involved in government by voting, by writing letters to their representatives, and even by organizing peaceful demonstrations to make their voices heard. Each American citizen has a vested interest in how he or she is governed. Former President Theodore Roosevelt expressed the American view of government well: "The government is us." At first glance, it might seem that the U.S. President, as leader of the free world, is the ruler of America. On Inauguration Day, the swearing-in of the U.S. President reflects the pomp and circumstance of a coronation ceremony, with dignitaries from around the world in attendance. People have sought to ascribe far-reaching powers to the President, but the Constitution ensures that the President will not become an all-powerful ruler. The U.S. government, as outlined by the Constitution, is divided into three branches: legislative, executive, and judicial. The legislative branch passes the laws, the executive enforces the laws, and the judicial interprets the laws.
The legislative branch is comprised of the two houses of Congress, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. The executive branch is represented by the President, who is called the Chief Executive or Chief of State. Besides that, as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, the President carries more than a little clout in world affairs. The judicial branch is made up of the Supreme Court and about 100 other federal courts. The 9 Supreme Court justices hold office for life. What does it mean to obey the law? That depends on where you are. Different cultures have very different views of obeying the law. In some cultures, law-abiding citizens try to keep the letter of the law. That is, whatever the law says, they do. In other cultures, good citizens live by the spirit of the law. They see the law only as a general guideline. Often they obey the law only when someone official is looking. The situation in America fits into the first category. That doesn't mean all Americans keep the law, but American culture teaches people to respect the law, even to the smallest detail. Driving habits illustrate American respect for the law. A driver will usually stop for a red light, even when there are no other cars around. People treat the lines marking streets and roads as definite boundaries, not just decorations. Vehicles yield to those with the right of way, particularly pedestrians. Actually, though, drivers don't always keep traffic rules. For example, many drivers ignore freeway speed limits. But Americans generally drive with careful attention to the rules. History gives several clues to explain American attitudes toward the law. The U.S. Constitution, the basis for all laws in America, reflects many historical influences. The Magna Carta, or Great Charter, was one. King John of England was forced to sign this document in 1215. It placed the king under the authority of the law. No longer was the king law, rather, the law was king. America's Christian heritage has also shaped how people view the law. For one thing, the Bible reveals God's unchanging laws which people must obey. It also teaches people to respect human authority as established by God. Of course, not everyone in America abides by the law. Crime is a growing problem. For that reason, law enforcement officials will never be out of a job. Police officers have their hands full trying to arrest lawbreakers. Detective agencies spend countless hours trying to figure out unsolved crimes. Nevertheless, most Americans still like to believe that the long arm of the law will eventually nab the bad guys. But even bad guys in America have the right to a fair trial. When a person is brought to an American court, he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Many ancient Eastern systems, in contrast, viewed an accused person as guilty until proven innocent. They used torture and other extreme measures to find out the truth. The American system tries to protect the rights of the accused. Still, the system is far from perfect. Court cases involving celebrities like O.J. Simpson can become media circuses. Skilled lawyers sometimes use minor issues to get their clients set free, and prison inmates may live even better than many poor citizens. No one believes a perfect legal system is possible, yet every society has laws. Whether people follow the letter of the law or just the spirit of the law, they recognize the need for laws to keep order in society. Without them, chaos would result. If every man were a law unto himself, no man would be free.
第22单元, 货币主权.
Unit 22, Money and Sovereignty.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
I am delighted to be here this evening, and I am glad that you could all join us to mark the opening of this splendid new exhibition. This is one of a regular series of exhibitions in the IMF Visitor Center, and on this occasion, we are very grateful to have the Smithsonian National Museum of American History as co-sponsor. Without access to this one of the largest such collections in the world, I think the displays would have looked somewhat less enticing than they do. In the fund, we deal with money every working day, of course, and are in one sense keenly aware of the relationship between money and sovereignty. But we rarely have time to reflect on the history of this relationship, which is why this exhibition is so fascinating. As you wander round the displays, and I hope you will take the time to do so later, you will see how deep-rooted the relationship is. Indeed, I am struck by how many of the most topical issues of modern-day international finance have echoes in the past. The introduction of the euro, for instance, went right to the heart of the debate about what national sovereignty means. It is exactly the debate now going on in Britain, Sweden, and Norway, and indeed in the 15 countries that will soon join the European Union. Our countries, both their governments and their populations, willing to see their national currency disappear in return for apparently intangible benefits such as greater efficiency and access to a larger market? Governments are often torn because the ability to print money can offer important advantages, especially for those who want to avoid fiscal discipline. And ordinary citizens have shown perhaps unexpectedly strong attachment to the pound, the franc, the peseta, and the lira. Trust in a currency takes a long time to build up. Europe's monetary union isn't exactly a novel idea. Several experiments were tried in Europe in the 19th century. Among the Scandinavian countries, where enthusiasm for the euro is notably lacking, and the short-lived Latin Monetary Union, an idea, I believe, inspired by Napoleon. But a similar debate about money and sovereignty took place here in the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the Roman Empire was the first fully monetized society. This exhibition reminds us that, at its peak, the empire had a population of 100 million people. It was, and in a sense, the forerunner of today's single European market. Dostoevsky once described money as coined liberty. I don't think he was talking about the liberty of states at the time, but there is no doubt that the right to issue a national currency has long been jealously guarded by states and sought after by those seeking national independence. Currency is seen as a symbol of national sovereignty, which is why the prospect of abandoning of a national currency is so painful a prospect to many people. The link between money and national identity is also clear from the importance that has always been attached to the design of notes and coins. The importance of symbolism goes right back to the Greeks, who, by the way, did not invent but rather adopted the idea of coinage. The eagle on American coins was first used as an image on Greek coinage. Given the constraint of the form, a small, usually round piece of metal, or a small piece of paper, the range and ingenuity of currency designers is impressive. That is clear from this exhibition, and it is also clear from the permanent display of all IMF member currencies to be seen along one of the corridors in the main part of the headquarters building. But history shows us that lovingly executed or imaginative design do not guarantee success or longevity. Currencies can lose their value rapidly because of inflation or political upheaval, or both. I am sure many of us have seen film footage of Germans during the hyperinflation of the 1920s, when half a day's pay needed a wheelbarrow to transport home. Hyperinflation was a chronic problem for many countries in the 1970s and 80s, especially in Latin America. And who now, for example, would attach any value other than sentimental to the Ostmark, the currency of the now defunct East Germany. One of the fund's most important tasks is to help countries achieve the macroeconomic stability that helps keep inflation in check and so maintains the domestic purchasing power of currencies. We are, in a sense, preaching the rewards of virtue, and in the context of this exhibition, it is interesting to see what Socrates had to say on this subject. I tell you that virtue does not come from money, but from virtue comes money and all other good things to man, both to the individual and to the state. Welcome to this exhibition. I wish you an enjoyable evening.
第23单元，国际政治。
Unit 23, International Politics.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
We are in an unprecedented period because for the first time ever, there is only one superpower. In a sense, there is therefore no balance of power. Will this situation persist? Well, the answer to that depends on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. Optimists believe that power politics will be subsumed within a constitutional world order shaped by a global ideology of human rights. I'm skeptical about this myself, more persuaded by the pessimists who believe there is no escape from power politics. They see another superpower emerging eventually, either through the decay of the United States or as the result of an outright challenge. The most obvious candidates would be China or a revitalized Russia. Others reject this dichotomy completely and anticipate a more evolutionary path, sometimes called the new medievalism, in which the relentless advance of information technology results in the demise of the state as we know it. The idea is that global communications will simultaneously empower individuals to create transnational virtual communities and make it more difficult for governments to control their populations. The result will be a new political landscape with overlapping jurisdictions for different aspects of life in place of territorial states with distinct jurisdictions. Again, I'm skeptical myself. We can't ultimately exist as virtual communities. We all have to live somewhere and pay our taxes. The resurgence of nationalism argues against this model in any case. In the first half of the 20th century, many believed that nationalism would give way to a world organized on liberal or communist principles. Some even believed in world government. But today the pressure is in the opposite direction, towards ethnic separatism. Since the end of the Cold War, much of the attention focused on nuclear and strategic issues has drained away to a dangerous extent, in fact. Weapons of mass destruction have not disappeared, and non-proliferation has now been seriously undermined by the nuclear tests in India and Pakistan. For the foreseeable future, though, a third world war seems unlikely. There is no major ideological fracture severe enough to sustain it. War itself won't disappear, but it will continue to be regional or local, more often within the state than between states. What about the balance of power? Well, the one thing that we can be sure about is the experts will get it wrong. How many of us predicted the end of the Cold War and the Soviet breakup? Our job is not to predict the future, but to improve understanding of the world we live in. On that front at least, I am optimistic about progress.
第24单元，就职演说。
Unit 24, An Inauguration Address.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
The peaceful transfer of authority is rare in history, yet common in our country. With a simple oath, we affirm old traditions and make new beginnings.
As I begin, I thank President Clinton for his service to our nation, and I thank Vice President Gore for a contest conducted with spirit and ended with grace. I am honored and humbled to stand here where so many of America's leaders have come before me, and so many will follow. We have a place, all of us, in a long story, a story we continue, but whose end we will not see. It is the story of a new world that became a friend and liberator of the old, a story of a slave-holding society that became a servant of freedom, a story of a power that went into the world to protect but not possess, to defend but not to conquer. It is the American story, a story of flawed and fallible people, united across the generations by grand and enduring ideals. The grandest of these ideals is an unfolding American promise that everyone belongs, that everyone deserves a chance, that no insignificant person was ever born. Americans are called to enact this promise in our lives and in our laws. And though our nation has sometimes halted and sometimes delayed, we must follow no other course. Through much of the last century, America's faith in freedom and democracy was a rock in a raging sea. Now it is a seed upon the wind, taking root in many nations. Our democratic faith is more than a creed of our country. It is the inborn hope of our humanity, an ideal we carry but do not own, a trust we bear and pass along. And even after nearly 225 years, we have a long way yet to travel. While many of our citizens prosper, others doubt the promise, even the justice, of our own country. The ambitions of some Americans are limited by failing schools and hidden prejudice and the circumstances of their birth. And sometimes our differences run so deep, it seems we share a continent but not a country. We do not accept this, and we will not allow it. Our unity, our union, is the serious work of leaders and citizens in every generation. And this is my solemn pledge. I will work to build a single nation of justice and opportunity. I know this is in our reach because we are guided by a power larger than ourselves who creates us equal in His image. And we are confident in principles that unite and lead us onward. America has never been united by blood or birth or soil. We are bound by ideals that move us beyond our backgrounds, lift us above our interests, and teach us what it means to be citizens. Every child must be taught these principles. Every citizen must uphold them. And every immigrant, by embracing these ideals, makes our country more, not less, American. Today, we affirm a new commitment to live out our nation's promise through civility, courage, compassion, and character. America, at its best, matches a commitment to principle with a concern for civility. A civil society demands from each of us goodwill and respect, fair dealing and forgiveness. What you do is as important as anything government does. I ask you to seek a common good beyond your comfort, to defend needed reforms against easy attacks, to serve your nation, beginning with your neighbor. I ask you to be citizens. Citizens, not spectators. Citizens, not subjects. Responsible citizens, building communities of service and a nation of character. Americans are generous and strong and decent, not because we believe in ourselves, but because we hold beliefs beyond ourselves. When this spirit of citizenship is missing, no government program can replace it. When this spirit is present, no wrong can stand against it. After the Declaration of Independence was signed, Virginia statesman John Page wrote to Thomas Jefferson, "We know the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Do you not think an angel rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm?" Much time has passed since Jefferson arrived for his inauguration. The years and changes accumulate. But the themes of this day he would know, our nation's grand story of courage and its simple dream of dignity. We are not this story's author, who fills time and eternity with his purpose. Yet his purpose is achieved in our duty, and our duty is fulfilled in service to one another. Never tiring, never yielding, never finishing, we renew that purpose today, to make our country more just and generous, to affirm the dignity of our lives and every life. This work continues, this story goes on, and an angel still rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm.